A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to Unfiltered with James O'Brien, brought to you by Joe.
Hello, I'm James O'Brien. Welcome to episode 22 of Unfiltered, featuring Richard Herring. He's on the road now with his latest stage show, Oh Frig, I'm 50. That brings him into the sort of 13 or 14 one-man show territories. But we'll look back at the Lee and Herring stuff and everything he did before, of course, becoming one of the first people to appreciate the power that podcasts would hold. Welcome.
Thank you.
Here. It's lovely to have you here. The way it works is we sort of we roam very aimlessly throughout your back catalogue and your personal life up to a point and your professional achievements, winding up with the latest tour, the latest one-man show, about your 18th or 19th, I think.
I think they're probably 13th show, but then I've done a couple of them a couple of times. I've toured every year since, apart from 2000, pretty much.
You've also said that 80% of the stuff you do is for free. This in the context of explaining that over the last 5 or 6 years, you've been working pretty much 7 days a week. So, I mean, have you fired your agent yet? How does that work?
But it's by choice. And I think most of the things that I was doing for free have started to pay off now.
Right.
And they pay off in different ways anyway. So I kind of really, I've just sort of, about 10 years ago, I was sort of aware of the internet all the time, really. You know, in the mid-90s, me and Stu, they had a website and we did quite a lot. Even with the TV show, we had an email address, which was quite unusual, and you know, people could get involved. And we liked that. And even before the internet, though, those shows were quite internet-y and that they were, people got involved and contributed to them. And so I was kind of always aware that there was this, you know, new territory that you could go into. And I think, I started writing a blog 15 years ago. Mm. And I did that partly just as a way of getting over writer's block. And then I realised, you know, if something's going up every day on a website, then people are coming to your website every day. So that's not a bad thing. And hopefully then they'll come and see you do some shows.
Yes.
And then with podcasting, it was just sort of the realisation that you could have the autonomy, have a stand-up. You know, what I love about stand-up. And I came back to stand-up quite late, really. But what I love about it is that, you know, you have an idea and you put it on and then you go and do it. So all my one-man shows are completely self-generated and no one tells me what I can and can't do.
Which obviously you felt too many people were doing too much.
Well, it's just so difficult, and it still is, to get things on TV and radio. And I have a fair degree of success compared to most people about getting stuff on TV and radio. But I felt like I had a lot of ideas, and most of them were just disappearing into the ether. So the thing that appealed to me about podcasts was just the idea of being able to make whatever you wanted to make. And I didn't really care about anything else. And early on, people going, but you're not going to make any money. And you go, well, it doesn't, you know, what matters is the work.
Yes.
And if the work's good, then presumably that will lead to other things.
A leap of faith, though. You had your fingers crossed a little bit.
Well, I just thought, everything I've done on the internet, I've just thought, I'm doing this for the sake of doing it. I'm not doing this, you know.
An end in itself.
Yeah, maybe like when we first did Collins and Herring, maybe we'd done a radio show and then stopped, then we did a podcast, and maybe at the back of our minds we thought, hey, if someone likes this, maybe they'll give us our radio show back,
yes,
you know.
Yes.
But that was it. And then we quickly realised, and we did get our radio show back. In fact, we did a radio show for a year. But we quickly realised there was value in it elsewhere, and especially for me, because I was touring And so if you're going into people's ears every week with a, you know, and making them laugh and it's free, then every now, you know, most people are going to go, oh, well, you know, A, he's coming to our town, let's go and see him. And B, I feel a bit guilty about these 50 hours of free entertainment. You know? Yeah, so, you know, we'll give him a pound or we'll buy him a cup of coffee or something. So, you know, it does, it sort of.
It's like the big issue of the comedy world.
But I suddenly realised, you know, and unintentionally, it was a kind of brilliant business model, because I'm not a businessman, but I noticed my tour audiences were doubled within 2 or 3 years.
And I mean, you say unintentionally, but you were way ahead of the game on that, because it's taken me quite, I mean, probably this actually, doing this podcast, it took me to realise 15 years after you started that the whole nature of, I mean, we have to use this language until someone comes up with better words, content delivery and all that sort of thing. It really is changing. People listening to this will be surprised to learn that someone like you, you know, a household name among the most successful comedians of your generation, still felt straitjacketed by broadcasters. They will presume you turn up, you see someone selling out big venues or someone who's really doing the business, and then the TV people just say, oh, come and do whatever you want on our station.
I mean, no, I mean, it's really hard. You know, it's really hard. Even when we were on, you know, me and Stu did TV for 4 or 5 years and we'd done radio. We worked together for 10, 13 years, something like that. And, you know, it was still, even though we were on TV, it was a struggle to stay on, and we nearly went off and then we stayed on. And, you know, and the regime changed, and I've still got that. You know, I've written a sitcom I'm very pleased with, and we did a taster tape of it and it was really good. And then everyone at the broadcaster changed to different people. And then, you know, you go in and have a terrible meeting with them and go, oh, well, that 3 years of work has gone down the toilet. So, you know, not necessarily. Hopefully someone else might do it. But it is... You know, you do. I think when I was doing the podcast, and I started doing As It Occurs to Me, which was like a stand up and sketch weekly thing, and that kind of was about the same time. I think I might have even pitched that as a radio show, and then I just realised it was just the time when all the Saxgate thing had broken with Russell Brand and Jonathan Ross, and the BBC were being so overcautious.
Right.
And you sort of think, I've got this place I can go and do whatever I want to do. And, you know, the whole thing with As It Occurs to Me, you come with this, I can be as rude as I like. And you go, for 2 weeks, you're just going terrible, you know, going insane. And then you go, yeah, that's just no fun. If you're allowed to do it, it's no fun. So, you know, you go back and it settles down into its own rhythm. But that freedom and that autonomy, you know, because I think what's weird to me is increasingly, and I think maybe it didn't used to happen so much on TV, and the things that are successful on TV, I think almost nearly always break this, is that an executive will see someone they like and then take a leap of faith for them and go, I like you and you obviously know what you're doing, so you go and do it. Whereas now, increasingly, you'll have an idea and they'll go, would it be better if this...
Or if it was a bit like that other thing that's done really well.
And so you go, you know, I've been writing scripts for the... You know, I got the notes I got back on my latest thing was going, this is a bit hack and this is a bit hack. And you go, I've been doing comedy for 30 years, okay? I go out every night and I do comedy. I know what's hack. If there's something in there that you think is hack, you either haven't got the joke or you don't understand why it's in there.
Yes.
But don't, you know, I wouldn't presume to go into someone, a doctor in working for 30 years and go, would it be better if you cured this disease?
You don't want to do it
by
like
doing
that.
You know, but that's increasingly how the... So it just seems to me counterintuitive. It shouldn't, you know, you find people you like and then take a chance with them. And that, I think that's where all the great stuff is. You know, Monty Python, they seem to be just left to themselves.
Yes.
Armando Iannucci, leave him to himself and he'll come up with something great. I was talking to Mackenzie Crook on my podcast the other week, and, you know, with Detectorist, he just went idea and they just went, hey, we love this. Let's, you know, go and do it. We trust you to do it. And I think you sort of have to do that to create really groundbreaking good comedy.
Let's go back to the beginning. I'm intrigued that you were born in Pocklington in Yorkshire. I was at school in Ampleforth, just around the corner. Effectively, yes, I was.
Well, but I don't remember much about it. We left very early, but my dad was a teacher in Pocklington.
At Pocklington School.
Yeah.
And then you ended up at the school where he was headmaster.
Yeah, but that was in Cheddar, so we moved down. School. That was a comprehensive school in Cheddar, but a very nice school.
I know you've mused on this in the past yourself, but if you have quite an anti-authoritarian streak, and your dad's a headmaster, you probably don't have to be Freud, do you?
Well, I think it's weird because I was, you know, I did the show Headmaster's Son, which was about trying to work out whether it affected me or not. And I think it definitely did affect me. But I was, at school, I was, you know, I was into comedy and I was into subversive comedy, but I was a very good...
What sort of stuff?
I loved, like, Pete and Dud and Monty Python, Young Ones. It was all that sort of stuff. So, you know, and I was getting hold of a lot of the stuff on records. Like, everyone else was listening to music. My friends were into punk and I was a little bit into punk. But I was just, you know, a Pete and Dud thing dropped into your lap and, yes, you know, you couldn't believe, I don't know how I got away with listening to it at 13 or 14.
No, because the language.
And how my parents obviously didn't know what
didn't
was going on.
Fully appreciate.
They were like, nice Pete Cook and Dudley.
He's got a hobby.
So you left off, you know, doing this stuff. So, you know, I loved all that stuff. So it was a subversive in terms of I loved comedy that was subversive. But I were, and I was naughty in that I was cheeky in lessons and trying to be funny all the time. I was a group of friends who had always trying to be funny, and we did student comedy and student magazines that were again a little bit subversive, but we were sort of really good as well. And right. I was trying to get to university, and I was clever, and I was getting good exam results.
But you already had the performer thing.
Yeah, I
going
think so.
On.
But I think all of it predates anything to do with my dad, though. So I think, you know, like I look at my, I realized at about four or five, I was kind of obsessed with, you know, this mysterious thing of sex without knowing too much about what it was, but have what even what I gleaned at five, I found it was obsessed with it, and nudity and swear, you know, saying poo and wee,
yes,
and stuff,
yes,
which my
taboos.
Daughter's just getting into, but just like that was exciting to me. But I was also really into funny, anything that was funny. I loved writing stories. You know, it was all kind of innate in there, really. I think it was inside me.
And did you always know then that it was potentially something you could do for a living?
No, I think I wanted to, and that was the dream. You know, you watch these people and you dreamt that you could do that. But like as a Somerset schoolboy with no grounding in showbiz, I remember going to my careers at officers meeting and, you know, and saying, well, I'd like to be a writer or an actor. And he's going, well, you know, those aren't on the form. You can't do those.
No,
you, you should work in a bank or, you know, or you're not going to be able to do it, because it wasn't a realistic avenue. Even then, you know, even when we started, really, you know, comedy wasn't something people went into as a living, you know. There'd be a very few people who'd got TV shows and might be successful in that way. But it wasn't like, oh, and now it is, because it's such an industry. And now people can go, oh, if I go into this, I could be Michael McIntyre and earn £1 million a night or whatever, you know. So I think that people look at it differently, but
who were the trailblazers for you then? Who's inspired you? Because Badil's done this podcast,
yeah,
and he's slightly older than you,
yeah.
And they kind of invented rock and roll comedy,
yes,
as it were.
Yeah.
So that presumably threw open some sort.
It did.
Of
I mean,
internal
they,
door.
We were sort of just a couple of years behind, yes, them, and with the same management as them. And it wasn't. It was probably unhelpful to us, because,
yeah,
I think,
course,
people just thought, oh, they're, you know, they're trying to. We weren't massive. I love David, and, you know, I think I'd seen his stand up, and, you know, I'd seen bits and pieces of Newman and Badil, and in pieces, wasn't it? But
sure.
But it was, you know, they weren't like a big influence on us. I think me and Stu came from very different sensibilities, but very similar sense of humours.
How did you meet?
We met at university, so we would met in the first term at university, and I think, again, everyone else was, we met sort of at the comedy club. We sort of missed each other a few times, and then we sort of met at a party, and we both sort of disliked everything else everyone was doing. And we both had done quite weird things in the first term that,
right,
we hadn't seen, but we'd heard of. And
on stage?
Yeah, yeah. Only on stage, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah.
And so he'd done a sketch about people standing at a bus stop with fruit. And, you know, all I'd heard was everyone going, this weird sketch. And I'd done a sketch about having a singing penis. So it probably sums the two of us up. And we both kind of felt we had something. We had the same sense of humour, but a very different way of coming at it. And I think that throughout everything we were doing, that was the case as well, in that I loved all those sort of sketch comedians. I loved the group comedy. I loved the young ones, but also, you know, I was very in.
And you liked collaborating.
I did. It took me a long time to become a solo comedian,
yes,
because I didn't think. I had a kind of weird, awful time in Edinburgh when we went in the Oxford Review, and we went up in 1988. And it was just at the point where stand-up comedy was massively in the ascendant. Student comedy was in the gutter,
right,
and they kicked us in the gutter. You know,
did they really?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we had a horrible time, and really sort of bullied. I understand why.
By the audiences?
No, by the other comedians, by,
right,
the stand-up. The stand-up comedians, you know, hated the perceived privilege and the fact that we'd all get on. And
this is interesting, because David Badil was saying that for that generation, which you're part of, 5 years previously, Footlights and the Oxford Review were pretty much golden tickets,
yeah,
and 5 years later they sort of became golden tickets again. So
a bit, yeah,
you're jumping from Fry and Emma Thompson,
yeah,
and Hugh Laurie to probably Robert Webb and David Mitchell,
yeah,
and then in the middle, people who actually, you were from quite a humble background. If your father,
yeah,
was a comprehensive school headmaster, it's not like, you know, silver spoon territory.
No.
But you were perceived as being...
Well, we represented, and I understand that, we represented the past privilege of...
Yes,
you know, and it's
unfair,
still,
you know.
Oh, yeah, I mean, everyone, I think the pianist went to public school, but all the five performers in the show were from comprehensive schools.
And yeah,
and so, you know, and that was, it annoyed me because I felt like what you want to do is get to a point where the nice, the posh universities and the good universities are open to everyone.
Sure.
And so you don't want to have them perceived as being these privileged places. You want them to be perceived as a place where you can get to if you work hard, which, you know, we had to, all of us had to work hard to get to, and we're very proud to get there. And then, but then as a comedian, you sort of had to be ashamed of it. And Stu sort of sided with, you know, not sided with them, but he realised he wanted to do stand-up. And I was still pushing. I want to do sketches. You know, I believe sketches. I didn't like the stand-ups because I didn't feel like I was going to be. Well, partly because of this experience. You know, I didn't think I was going to be accepted. I didn't feel like a solo performer, and I always felt I did better with other people. And I was, you know, I did better in sketches. I was sort of perceived as the performer at university. I was in the Oxford Review. I did lots of acting. So that it just and I think a bit like David Mitchell. David Mitchell's never gone into doing stand-up. He would be an amazing stand-up if he wanted to do it. But I think It's a baptism of fire, stand-up. You know, it's a difficult thing to do, and especially coming from a different background. I did stand-up for 2 or 3 years.
So you can hide behind a singing penis
or an accent or a character. And I was when I did stand-up to begin with, I was sort of veering between characters and myself and trying to please myself and trying to please the people who were booking. And I never quite... Sometimes I'd do well, sometimes I'd do really badly. And then, you know, the double act stuff started taking off and the writing started taking off, so I kind of dumped the stand-up.
Were you analysing it to this degree at the time?
Yeah. No,
really?
Yeah. It was rare. Well, we were very into. I was just into comedy in a way that other. And I'm not into music. I listen to music now, and I enjoy music more than I used to. But it didn't. I sort of disliked music because I felt it. I mean, I suppose comedy does well, and any taste in anything does. But it seemed to me to divide people. You know, someone would say, "I like Phil Collins, and I like the Sex Pistols, so we can never be friends." Yes, and you kind of go, "That's." I mean, it possibly is a good way of discovering whether you're compatible, but also, you know, it seemed weird as the way that cliques were formed at school, and I kind of didn't like that. Though I'm sure, you know, I would probably have been as snotty as if someone had said they liked Last of the Summer Wine, an unlikely event. You know, I would have said, well, I like the young ones. It was good.
It almost like you had a plan already. Or not?
I mean, I think a little bit. We sort of, you know, I'd read this book From Fringe to Flying Circus, so all my heroes were Monty Python and, you know, Rowan Atkinson, and, you know, not in this book, but the young ones, they'd gone to Manchester. But all these people have gone to university, done student comedy, and then gone to London and done stuff. So
I knew there was a path.
I had that plan, but I went to university thinking, there's no way, you know, I was just thinking the Oxford View is this, you know, Michael Palin, Terry Jones, Rowan Atkinson, it's this revered thing I'll never get in. And it's, you know, it is so fragile because, like, I remember doing, I did that singing penis sketch at the fortnightly club, and I remember just some of the other comedians from the year above sitting in the front row going, oh, well, you know, I could hear them commenting on it, you know, going, what's all this about, you know, and you just think it's so fragile because if that had just broken and everyone going, oh, that's that terrible guy who does that terrible singing penis thing.
Yes.
But because it kind of resonated with some other people, it was okay. And we sort of just suddenly did really well, you know. So we formed this little sketch troupe together, and we sort of did the weekly shows, which we were very lucky, had just started up this fortnightly shows. And every week we sort of stormed it with we'd write new material every week, and we'd write 4 or 5 sketches. And then we nearly became the Oxford Review that year. And then instead they gave us a separate show at lunchtime, which was a bit of a sort of damn squib.
Sure.
But it meant then we went back to university the next term, and we got direct from the Edinburgh Fringe, boom, and we just were this phenomenon. It was like insane, you know. So it was called the Seven Raymonds, we were called, because it was the idea that, like, the two Ronnies had got together, but there were 7 people called Raymond, and they'd all got together, but, like, no one was called Raymond, and there were 6 of us, so it was loads of terrible jokes in there.
But you rocked it.
But it just went insane, you know, and so we were just the stars of the university scene. Yeah. It was like a tiny, like, 100-seater room, probably, but we did 5 nights, and they just sold out, and it was standing, you know, people standing and going.
So you were sort of famous on campus?
Just very quickly, you know, it sort of built quite quickly in that year, the couple of terms before we went away, but when we came back from. Because none of the freshers knew that meant nothing, that we'd been to the Edinburgh Fringe. So and then we'd been to the Edinburgh Fringe, and 5 people had seen us every lunchtime.
But you're back as conquering heroes.
Yeah. And so, you know, so we had this great, you know, we had a lovely time where we had 3 years to experiment with comedy, and there was a little bit of a taste of the real world that year. I went to Edinburgh and got kicked down and nearly gave up, to be honest. It was so bad.
What would you have done if you had?
I presume I'd have been a teacher because that's what everyone else, and near everyone else in my family's a teacher. And, you know, it's, there's similarities.
Of course there are.
But I'm glad, you know, I'm glad I didn't go that way.
So when did you first get handed a packet of cash?
Well, I remember we got paid quite quickly for doing like a, we did it, the five of us at college, and we got 50 quid, so we got £10 each, and I genuinely couldn't believe. It was like probably within a couple of months of us forming this group, we had to do half an hour of comedy and they gave me £10 and I nearly framed it, genuinely. I didn't spend it because I didn't have any money. And then, you know, I think like in Edinburgh, we got like invited to play in a bar and it was a similar sort of thing. Yeah. Like we came to sketches in a bar and like at lunchtime in a pub doing stupid student sketches. And, you know, again, they gave us free food and £10 each or something like that. And I just couldn't, it just was unbelievable. So that was the idea that anyone would pay us for doing this was insane. But yeah, that came quite quickly in those terms. So as a student, that was quite helpful. Yeah. If, you know, every weekend you were earning a little bit of money. But it was mainly doing free gigs.
And then as graduation approaches and you are obviously you've decided to give, I mean, together you decided, you and Stu together we'll try and...
I mean, Stu
different
was,
world now, isn't it? For younger people listening to this, the idea that you could have actually given yourself a year or two to see if it happened or not, they will find very hard to believe.
Well, listen,
they
literally come to London.
Can't eat if they...
Yeah, yeah. We said, let's go to London and live in like in the cheapest place we can live and have no money and eat baked potatoes. But even so, you know, my rent was...
And you'd shed the other Raymonds by this point.
Yeah, well, they're all our friends, but we weren't working together. But yeah, me and Stu came and we shared a flat with... well, actually, one of the other Raymonds was in the house. It was in Acton, and I think we paid £60 a week each for, you know, like a room in this house. So, you know, that was achievable. And there were things like enterprise allowance. I got on the enterprise allowance quite quickly, and that basically paid you £40 a week, and anything you earned you could keep. And I think you still got your house, your money for your rent. So I had a couple of years where you really helped it through. Mm. But yeah, I basically decided let's do 5 years and see where we are in 5 years.
What did your dad think?
They were quite supportive, but I think because my brother's a bit older than me and he's about 6 years older than me, and he'd really wanted to be quite a serious writer, you know, he's quite a poet, and they'd sort of dissuaded him from doing it because they wanted him to settle down and be sensible. And then it didn't, that made him more upset, obviously. And I think they realised that you just got to see what happens, you know, let people have a go and stuff. Yes. And I think being the younger one, it just helped out having that, you know, a bit more freedom. You're not quite as responsible are you when you're the youngest one? So they also at being a bit, you know, being the 1980s rather than the 1970s, I think it made a difference. Yeah. The world had moved on a little bit, and it felt like this wasn't a ridiculous. They were nervous about it, I think.
Sure, but they felt it was achievable.
Yeah, I mean, they'd
seen your stuff and they thought you were quite good as well.
They'd seen it, and I don't know if they thought it was good, but I think they just realised I wanted to do it, and they were going to let me. You know, and they were supportive, and they you know, they when I bought my first flat again when it was possible to do. Yeah. We were just about to do a TV series, so I knew I could pay them back, but they lent me £10,000.
Right.
We weren't getting paid very much for the TV series, but I knew I could pay them back pretty quickly. And so that was my deposit on the flat. Imagine being able to put £10,000 down on a flat and then still be able to afford a mortgage.
Unbelievable.
So, you know, it was, they were, yeah, they did, they were.
I like the idea that they had faith in you though. That's nice. I saw Nigel Haver speaking recently about Jack Whitehall.
Right.
He's his godfather.
Right.
And he went to see him above a pub in Hampstead or something shortly after he left school. I think you might have to find something else. Not sure this is going to work for you, Jacko. So you do. It takes a little bit of confidence. And when you and Stuart started, I mean, you did the normal circuit, presumably.
Yeah, we did the standard circuit. And like Stuart, you know, so again, coming at it from slightly different angles, I knew all about like Radio 4 and weekending and stuff. Well, my brother's friend at school coincidentally had been through all the weekending thing and I think wasn't doing it anymore, but I knew all that existed. And Stu had really kind of got to grips with where the stand-up circuit was and was very... I mean, he was just focused on that, really. The stuff we did together was like a sideline for him. He always wanted to be, you know, to do what he's doing now, which is good. But, you know, he was always working along parallel. I was really pushing everything into the double act through the 90s, which made the kind of transition a little bit difficult.
Tougher for you.
Yeah, because I didn't really have any, Why do you think that was? Because I decided to be part of a double act, but what I did in the double act wouldn't work outside of...
No, but also personality-wise, why do you think that was?
Well, you know, he's very... driven in himself, and
you're not coming across as lackadaisical yourself.
No, I'm not, but I am much more of a, you know, I like the idea of comedy as a community and doing stuff with other people. And he was, and you know, and a lot of stand-ups are entirely autonomous and can't work with other people. And Stu can work with other people and is you know, his giving and all those sort of things. But he, you know, he knew what he wanted, and what he really wanted was to be what he is now, which is fantastic.
And everybody has a sort of favourite gear.
Yeah.
Yours is different from his.
Yeah. So, you know, it was so because I'd invested everything in the doublet, it was when we stopped doing the doublet, it was like a couple of years of, oh, you know,
we slowed down.
What does
we've only just got the doublet off the ground.
Yeah, but where do I go?
I don't want to start. So then you started collaborating with people like Chris Morris. You worked on The Hour.
Yeah.
Were you working on that together, you and Stu?
Me and Stu we wrote as a double.
Yeah,
we were doing the stand up circuit separately.
Right.
And we were going to the Radio 4 and writing for Weekending, which neither of us really liked, but it was a good place to meet producers.
Yes, of course. Why didn't you like it? Because it's a bit production line.
Well, it was just not our sense of humour, and it was, you know...
It's quite news-based.
And a bit hack. It was generally a bit like, you know, when we did On The Hour, we wrote a sketch about someone going to a Weekending style
thing. Of course, you don't register, do you? But that is, in many ways, it's taking the piss out of precisely... The things you've just said about Weekending. So,
but we did Weekending, and it was really good to do it because, A, it was a way of... You had to write stuff quickly, you had to write things succinctly, you had best chance to get a 20-second sketch on. That wasn't our natural thing. You know, we like to write 10-minute sketches, but they were never going to get onto Weekending. And then it also gave you an idea. You know, you would have one producer would come on and use... we had Harry Thompson who did it 1 week, and he used 12 minutes of material from me and Stuart, which was unheard of. Like, this big room of writers, and we wrote over half the show.
Right.
And that was insane. But that had followed 8 weeks with Diane Messiahs as a producer, who'd used one 20-second sketch.
Still remember the name.
Yep. But that was a difficult 8 weeks because I was relying a lot on that. You know,
and you only get paid for what's used.
Yeah, you only get well. We get you
kind
get,
of.
You get £20 commission if you've got to be a commissioned writer. So you've got 1 minute maybe.
Right.
We might have had to split that. It might have been £20 each. But every minute we got extra, we'd get £20 between the two of us.
Gosh.
So you know, it was between what you got to eat or drink at the end of the week.
Yeah.
We met. Armando did it, and we did know Armando.
He there as a producer?
He was a producer, yeah.
Okay.
So he went. He's
done this as well, and quite unintentionally. There've been quite a lot of dovetailings in all of the Unfiltered. Not all of it, obviously. you probably haven't got much in common with the female genital mutilation campaign in Imco Alley. Although if we keep talking for long enough, we'll find some connections. Because he felt, and this has been a little bit missing from what you've told me so far, he kind of felt almost blessed that he suddenly, after coming down from Scotland, found himself working at BBC London, it would have been, with Steve Coogan and Chris Morris and people like that. Whereas with you, there's more of a sense of it being the result of effort rather than a kind of magic wand moment.
It all happened pretty fast, you know. So, all the things that those stand-up comedians said about Oxford sort of is slightly true. We met Armando and Sarah Smith, who did our producing for a few years. We didn't really know her at Oxford. She was a couple of years ahead of us, but you know, I don't think that hurt.
No.
But actually, what the thing that cemented us to them was doing both of them did Weekending, and both of them really liked what we were writing for Weekending. So
Sure.
You know, we probably came from a similar sensibility, which doesn't, you know, which is the reason show business is how it is, and maybe it will change. But Armando produced Weekending, and we really fitted in with what he was trying to do. And so he said, you know, I'm doing this other show which he even tried doing a little bit in Weekending. He tried to make Weekending a bit different and, you know, to an extent succeeded. And he said, will you come and help on this other show? And Armando is, you know, that's where his genius was. He spotted all the people he spotted for that show have gone on to be in some way.
It's actually unbelievable.
And he was, you know, pretty much the first person to spot it. So even Steve Coogan, Steve had done a bit of telly and he'd been doing, you know, he was just doing a W.H. Smith advert where he was doing Frank Spencer and all that sort of stuff.
And spitting image voices.
Yeah,
spitting image
voices, of course. So he was, you know, he was rich and well, you know, when we worked with him, you'd go to his flat and there'd be checks lying around that he hadn't sent to the bank, you know, and me and Stu were going...
He'd left those out just before you arrived. He'd run around putting them on the sideboard.
Yeah. You go, but this is from 5 months ago. You know, me and... Oh, no, especially me, because Stu was earning a bit of money from stand-up. I was earning a bit of pittance from writing for the radio. And so seeing someone, you know, he was making advert money, he was making TV money.
Big. But especially then as well, it was really astonishing.
But he was doing very mainstream, you know, and spitting image a bit less so, but he was doing... He could easily have gone Bobby Davro
or
Michael Barrymore.
Yeah.
But Armando saw him and spotted something
God, I didn't know that.
Bigger in than that. And, you know, put him in on the air. And Chris Morris, again, it's not a difficult thing to spot. What Chris Morris was doing at Radio Bristol was interesting and great. But, oh, man, it said, yes, that will work in this framework.
He's like an alchemist, isn't he?
Yeah. And then, you know, but then Rebecca Front, Dune McKeegan, David Schneider. I mean, all these people. And Stephen Wells was one of the writers. David Quantick was one of the writers. You know, all these people who are... And, you know, it was me and Stu's first main job. And so, yeah, it's this incredible Patrick Marber as well. I mustn't forget him.
Is it true that you still dispute the origin of Peter O'Hanrahan?
Oh, well, that's definitely true. I mean, that was
with Patrick Marber. You both claim.
Well, what happened? Well, that was interesting, and that was because we ended up splitting from On the Hour when it went to Day to Day, and it was massive for me because we were about to get like a 13, and I remember it was a 13-minute TV commission between the two of us, so 6 minutes of TV each, and I can't remember what the figure was, but you know, it wasn't £20 a minute.
Sure.
So this was life-changing money for me. And also, I knew that this show was going to be Monty Python of the 1990s. You know, you knew that this was it. And we got into a sort of dispute from a manager about ownership of characters and whether we would be, you know...
Yeah.
And so, he was right. And he was like, they were all so keen to go to the BBC, they weren't deciding who owned what and blah, blah, blah. And so, like, if our manager had... got his way and we'd been in that show and part of that deal had been you own 1% of Alan Partridge, then the rest of my life would have been very different, and not necessarily in a good way, but he was right to make that distinction. But it was a massive...
I don't understand why you had to separate, though. Well, because you and Stuart had got this other offer.
They wouldn't give us ownership of the characters we felt we'd co-created, and it was partly because On the Hour was... I mean, it's convoluted. On the Hour was written in a way where we would come up with ideas and then the cast would go and improvise them.
Oh, I see. So who actually came up with
that? So the Peter O'Hanrahan...
You'd be nothing without me.
Peter O'Hanrahan's very interesting. O'Hanrahan. And it's a very Lee and Herring premise.
Yes, it is.
And what I can tell you how it started, where it came from.
Is it still disputed?
I don't think anyone would dispute this, but this is where this story shows where it's interesting. I was in bed... listened to Radio 4 on the morning the Maastricht Treaty was printed.
Blimey,
And it was the morning the Maastricht Treaty, this massive thing, and the Radio 4 said to the reporter, "So what's in the Maastricht Treaty?" And this guy goes, "Well..." And he does the whole thing.
297 pages.
And he's trying to get his way through this. So I went into the office and I said, "This is brilliant. A thing where the reporter clearly doesn't know anything about it and has to completely waffle his way through it and blah, blah, and gets challenged and still has to fight." And they went, "Great." And then they went away and improvised that. I know it might have even been about the Maastricht Treaty, the first one. And it was on pick of the week. It was picked out of the show and it was on pick of the week. And I thought, I heard it went and brilliant. And they said, "That sketch written by Amanda Iannucci and Patrick Marber." And I kind of went in the next day and said, why was I not given a credit on the thing? And I said, "Well, you just heard it on the radio." And you kind of go, "That is the entire premise of this entire thing." So it wasn't in any way... you know, everyone was working so hard at it, it didn't matter. And it really didn't matter at that stage, but that was sort of... basically the seed that was going to grow. You know, and I remember thinking, well, that's a bit rich and it's a bit unfair. And, like, it became like they were going away and winning writing awards for it, and someone would go, "Oh, well done on your..." You know, we'd meet a producer in the lift and go, "Well done on... You know what? Congratulations."
You're a bit younger than them. A little bit.
And you know,
if you'd been on the performing roster rather than just the writing roster, would you have processed it differently?
I think it would have been a different thing. So what was quite interesting about it was that Patrick in the first series wasn't writing any of it and was one of the performers, and then in the second series he wanted to write stuff, and it was almost like a little joke amongst the writers that he was coming in and doing substandard versions of everything we were doing.
Right.
But then he said, "Why don't we go to Edinburgh and do a stand-up show, do a sketch show together? Try and do This Was the Week with What, you know, try and be that you know, the Peter Cook, Beyond the Fringe. Let's try and be the 1990s Beyond the Fringe." So it was Steve Coogan, Patrick Marber, and me and Stu, and also Simon Munnery, who we all really liked. And we were going to write, but it became apparent that Patrick had asked us to do it so that we would write loads of funny stuff for them. And because of that imbalance, because we were the writers and they were the performers, and they perceived us themselves as the performers of On the Hour and us as the writers of On the Hour, if we were trying to pitch stuff to be in it ourselves. And that was a tough room to be.
Yes, of course.
When they're handing out the parts and go, "Who wants to play this, Steve Coogan or Richard Herring?" You kind of go... I'd like to play. But, yeah, Steve probably would do it better. So, you know, that was difficult. But we had this... again, that was, I think, part of the problem. We had this very difficult Edinburgh together where that should have been an amazing show.
Yes.
And Nearly was. Sure. No one came to see it. It was the year Steve won the Perrier with his other show that Patrick directed. And, you know, we were getting no one come to see it and we were infighting and it was just sort of weird. And then, but in the last week, a producer came, Peter Kessler came and said, oh, I love this. We'd love to put this on the telly. And suddenly Patrick was like 100% behind, you know. So Patrick had this, he was more ambitious or more brazenly ambitious than everyone else. I'm sure we were all as ambitious, but he was just, you could see him, you could see it cogitating and you could see where he was forming alliances. And it was weird for us when, you know, in the end, Patrick ended up owning 50% of Alan Partridge and 100% of some of Steve's characters. I think Steve felt in awe of this, in awe of this Oxbridge thing. And didn't realise that he, in many ways, was the genius behind all of what he does.
Of course.
And so he wanted these people to help him out and then was very generous, in fact, with the people who did go on to co-create the stuff in kind of giving them ownership.
But not you.
But we didn't. Because we, you know, it was the wrong point. But yeah,
clearly.
But...
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Again, you know, I look at all the things, all those points in your career where you go,
yeah, of course.
What if I'd walked? You know, I could have walked away from Avalon and Stuart. I could have said, I wanted to do it and I didn't agree. I said it's more important we're in it. And my manager and Stu said, no, it's more important we own the characters.
Oh, really? Is that right?
And I could have walked away. I could have said, well,
I'll stay with them.
I'll stay with them and goodbye, Avalon, goodbye,
Did you? Stuart. Did you have sort of sleepless nights over
I thought about it, but, I had loyalty to Stu, but I also thought we had something interesting together.
Right.
But had we gone on to write on the hour, you know, Peter Bainham took our place, who's a friend of ours, and who I'm interviewing tonight, He, you know, when they had a photo of the cast, there wasn't Peter Bainham in the end typing. You know, he wasn't. And he's gone on to get lots of stuff after having done that job.
He got on screen as well, didn't he?
He did a little bit, but not, you know, but hardly. So it's, you know, I think if we'd been the writers, and it would have been a different life, and it may have been a wonderful life.
But
I would have been writing for some incarnation of Alan Partridge, or, you know, it would have been interesting, and it would have been.
But you had
lucrative.
That thing inside you that wanted to.
I just think,
perform.
Yeah,
because Robert Webb spoke to us about this, and they got to sort of nearly 30, and the writing was paying the mortgage, and they were making their way. But he said that was the point at which I began to wonder whether the performing would ever happen.
Yeah,
and if it hadn't happened, you know, like you just said, I could still have had a perfectly fulfilling, successful career, but it wouldn't have been this career.
Well, it just, there's so, you know, the older you get and the more you look at stuff, you become so much more philosophical about everything.
You do.
Like, and you just go, hey, well, I'm glad this happened because it led to this.
Yeah.
And this wouldn't have happened. You know, you wouldn't be with, I wouldn't have the children I have, and I wouldn't have the wife I have.
No, I know.
All those things. So you're glad about all of that part. But also, I wouldn't be having the career I have now, and I wouldn't have wanted the career I have now. If I'd been given the toss-up, even probably 20 years or 15 years ago, they said, do you want to be David Mitchell or do you want to be a bloke making his own stuff on the internet? I'd have said, I want to be David Mitchell, please. But now I would rather be me.
Yes, of course.
So it's, and that's sort of interesting.
It's weird how much you put on stuff, isn't it, when you're young? That idea that I used to do this thing where I'd look at women getting jobs and I'd be jealous.
Right.
And now I sort of look back and think, you were never going to get a job if they were looking for it. The Sky did a thing once where they'd just done the 3 a.m. girls in the Daily Mirror and they said, we want to do a news version of that. Do you know any women? And I said, well, yeah, but can I try out for it? And this is mid-20s. It's a tough period, isn't it? And you kind of, also, I think you feel that if it doesn't happen now, it might never happen.
Yeah, yeah.
So you'd got over that hump. You were actually weighing up different options. You weren't thinking, if this doesn't, I'm back measuring inside legs on Regent Street by the end of next week, which would have been my thing. And you do, as you get older, you do begin to look over things. You think, what were you thinking of?
Yeah, well, you know, you're driven and, you know, I'm sure, like I say, we were all ambitious really in that
of
way
course.
That Patrick was and that we mocked him probably for the time. And we were all, it was only here, you know, it was more apparent with him. And, you know, and there are those moments, and some of them are betrayals and some of them aren't. They feel like betrayals.
But it's all part of the journey.
Someone's been given an opportunity and, you know, they have to make a choice.
So what was the first thing that kicked off after you'd walked away from On the Arrow? Would it have been... would it have been Fist of Fun?
I mean, sort of. So we were, all this time we were also working up. So On the Hour, we'd started working on a radio show called Lionel Nimrod's Inexplicable World. And I think we'd done a couple of other bits and pieces as well. So there were little things coming up. So, yeah, our own little radio career was going okay. And so we did Fist of Fun.
For Radio 1, people...
Yeah, so we did Fist... I'm trying to think. Yeah, Fist... We did Lionel Nimrod, and it was Radio 4. And then Radio 1 put some of them on late night. And then Radio 1 suddenly decided they wanted to do late night comedy. And so, again, incredibly lucky to be in that position. Chris Morris did the show. Armando did a show. The Ginger Prince. Do you remember the Ginger Prince? I can't remember what they were called now. But there was another sort of trendy, slightly comedy show. First of all, Fist of Fun, which was like a tour show doing sketches around universities. And then the Lee and Herring show, which was... like a studio-based DJ show, but we cut to sketches, but we also took calls, and, you know, it was live. So just incredibly fortunate again to get several hours of this.
Quite exposed,
radio show.
Though. If you muff up that kind of, I mean, live is
yeah.
Quite...
I mean, I don't think we ever really thought. I mean, we did make mistakes. I remember one time that I had the headphones on wrong, and I was looking at the clock, and I didn't know that I thought the producer's voice came in either headphone. No one had told, so I had one headphone on, I think. And I was looking at the clock, and the second hand was coming out, and no one seemed to be going. You know, and I was going, and now we must go over to Manchester for Mark Radcliffe. And everyone else was looking at me going,
what are you doing?
And then I said, well, no, we've got to go. And I couldn't understand why they hadn't cut. And then the producer had been saying, hey, there's another minute. You've got you've misread the clock. And so there was just this awful eggy. And I was very self-conscious. I was very embarrassed. And I kind of stormed off in a huff because I couldn't stand the embarrassment. because it had been, you know, I was going, I didn't know that, you know, I thought it came out both ears, the producer's voice. And she was going, everyone knows it only comes out one ear, which he didn't know. And so, you know, but those moments are funny. But yeah, it's that mixture. I was so self-conscious and scared, but also just had
Every, the impression, we're just over halfway, and that's the first sign of vulnerability that you've even shown. I mean, and it's odd that, because...
Well, I was very insecure because of this whole... I think
you kept doing
lot of,
things. This is the weird mixture between the look at me gene and the insecurity, isn't it? Because you kind of keep doing things that expose you to possible humiliation on quite a large stage.
Yeah. I mean, that's comedy, though. I mean, that's the irony of the stand-up comedian, you know. And some of them aren't. Some stand-up comedians are the same on and off stage, but mostly there's a lot of, you know, nobody's quite that heightened. And if they are that heightened off stage, then you don't want to hang around with them. But yeah, there's a massive insecurity, and there has to be, because if you... I don't know. There are different types of comedians, because I was talking about this as well. There's very confident comedians, and they're often either the absolute best or the absolute worst.
Yes, yes.
So the absolute worst open spots... just believe they are the best. They go on, they die, they believe they've done amazingly well.
They're the best.
They don't even notice they've died.
Yeah. It's almost enviable, isn't it?
That it's sort of is for this. And I would, and Stu had it to his sense. So I would watch Stu and he'd come off and go, I was the best on tonight. I went the best. And you kind of go, objectively, you were the best, but you weren't, the audience didn't think you were.
Top three.
And, you know, but he believed it and that was enough to push it on. And he was very good. But equally, you know, someone will go on and I would always beat myself up about mistakes, and Stu would always beat me up about my mistakes as well,
but not his own.
He'd always apologise for me and never for himself. So it was that kind of big brother, little brother relationship. And he didn't have siblings, and I think he kind of didn't, you know, quite get how that worked.
Give and take, compromise.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
50-50.
So I think I'd been really shaken. I think if I hadn't had that experience in Edinburgh,
I don't think
I'd have been as shaken as I was. But I was really, I was very confident and doing lots of plays and lots of acting at university. And then that got taken out of me. I was doing that dumb show thing with Patrick Marby, who was telling me I couldn't act. And so I was all the time losing this confidence. Yeah. But then, yeah, still managing to go on and do things.
Bust yourself down.
Yeah, and push yourself. But you know, Stu was doing loads of stand-up and was telling... And when we were doing the double act, he was going, look, I've done all this stand-up. You don't know what you're doing. I've done this much more. And I had to go to him. I've done exactly as much being in a double act as you have,
yes,
so I know
exactly
as much.
It's a very different dynamic. It's a completely different thing. So then it was This Morning with Richard, Not Judy, was it?
Yeah, we did Fist of Fun on... We did the Fist of Fun on the radio, then we did Fist of Fun on the TV with two series. So we had a series where...
So you're famous now, are you, Richard?
Well, no, kind of... I mean, it was... We never really... It never took off in that way. It never took off in that Newman and Madea way.
Right.
We would tour and 80 people might come and see. We'd be in a big theatre, but 80 people would come and see
Seriously?
Us.
Seriously?
Yeah. And occasionally it'd be a couple hundred. And once it was 800 cases right. in Brighton. Towards the end of the Leon Herring stuff. I think a lot of people were watching it, but a lot of them, the ones who liked it, were probably 13 and not able to come out. So, which I think, but that was me. That was me at 13. I was, you know, I wouldn't have been able to go and see Monty Python, even if they'd gone to Western Supermare.
No, of course I wouldn't
have been allowed to go. So it's.
Were you lonely at this time?
I was. I was because I found it difficult to cope with, and I wasn't great at. Foisting. I was always worried about foisting yourself on other people.
Yes.
So I'd spend a lot of time just in my flat. And I did. We had friends and we did have an amazing time. And
sure.
there was great stuff going on. But there was a lot of time on a Friday and Saturday where I'd go, oh, God, I haven't arranged to do anything. And it's too late to ring anyone now because they'll all have arranged everything.
Yeah.
And I think that's where, and everyone was probably the same, or many people were the same. Yes. It was before the internet where you could have gone, oh, you'd tweet.
It was a bit of a production to get stuff together.
So, you know, you could have just seen someone else on Twitter and gone, oh, yeah, do you want to have a drink? But it was difficult because we were working very intensely, and so I think me and Stu were friends, and then we were just in each other's pockets. So you know we would go out drinking for a bit, and then just wanted to get away from each other. But then we would mainly the main people that each other knew. But then he was doing stand up and knew more comedians and stuff.
Was
so,
that
yeah.
gap getting bigger then? Were you more and more conscious of the fact that he had two? Careers and you only had one?
A little bit. And I just, you know, I think he had a little bit more disdain for our stuff, I think, you know, because he hadn't written it all. He had that kind of confidence that that in himself. So some of my things he didn't like. Generally, if we didn't both like something, we wouldn't do it.
Mm.
And so we'd, you know, he would do it in his own thing or, you know, I'd save it up for something else.
Yes.
But, you know, I was doing more of the legwork in the writing. I was doing all the editing of all the radio stuff. I was, you know, script editing it. I can't
work out how much of you is front of house and how much of you is backstage.
Right.
In percentage terms. I can't work out how much of you is front and centre and how much of you is writing it and putting it together and helping other people.
I think, like, with Leon Herring, because he had
well, I don't
distractions.
Mean Leon Herring, I mean just you. I mean, how much of you is the performer and how much of you is the craftsman?
Increasingly, it's difficult to say.
And it's changed
things.
In the course of your career, hasn't it?
Increasingly, I'm more myself on stage. That's a different thing.
But it's taken a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's, you know, and that's why I'm lucky.
Yes.
No, most people don't, you know, most people don't get the opportunity to do 13 one-man shows.
No.
Well, without either becoming really successful or being told to go away.
Yes, of course. Need that weird apprenticeship lots of different strands.
So I've got very, very good at doing stand-up, but I'm not really on anyone's rate. You know, the people, luckily, people know I'm there and they'll come and see me. And I'm almost, you know, I'm still amazed. If 250 people come see me in a little town, I'm going, where the hell have these people come from? Where do they know me from? And why they keep coming back, you know? Because you still don't believe in yourself that much. But it's when you think, actually, you know, there's 500 people in here tonight. There's 100 people
and
in here tonight.
And they've had a good time.
You know, but they've had a nice time and they've come back.
Yes.
So it's a big thing to give up a night, to give up, you know, 30, 40 quid.
Yeah.
And especially as a parent, you suddenly realise, don't you, those precious nights off.
Yes,
if you've made that decision to go and see someone, A, it makes me think, I've got to give them an amazing time, which 10 years ago, sometimes I think I'm going to deliberately annoy them tonight and make them uncomfortable. I wouldn't do that now because I think, look, Christ, this might be your one night a month where you're having a nice time with your partner. I want you to have a really good time. You really appreciate that.
So when you went your separate ways, was it like a divorce?
It was. Well, it was foisted on us because we were doing, you know, if they'd given us another series, we would have done another series.
Right.
I'm not sure we'd have done many more series. But there have been double acts that's happened to. They've had that break and they were about to stop working with each other and then they're forced to work together for a long time, you know, and then they're very successful. And I'm glad it didn't happen to us, really. I'm glad we had that time together. Mainly I look back and with happy memories, there's bad things in there. And weirdly, I think with this morning, if you watch them, the first one, people are just flabbergasted by it's almost silent.
Yes.
The last one is just
they're
like,
on the joke.
Everyone gets it. And we're just getting to the point where newspapers starting to go, hey, there's this amazing show. It was such a weird thing. You know, I wanted to do this slot. I loved Saturday morning TV, yeah, like Tiz was, and the Banana Splits and all this stuff. I wanted that kind of, and I wanted, it was my idea to do this slot of Sunday, live on Sunday lunchtime. We did it live because we'd hated all the effort we had to do with Fist of Fun, where it took 4 hours to record 30 minutes. Well, just redo it. And you thought, well, let's do it. Stu wasn't that keen on doing it live, but I really wanted to do it live.
Very, very different forces, aren't they?
Yeah,
completely different beasts.
And it just meant we'd done it, and it was great, you know. But it was this amazing thing, but it was on at 12 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm. And then the repeat kept on getting moved around, so people weren't really able to get into it. But people had got into it, and again, it was the regime change. The new controller came in and she stayed for a long time and she didn't get it at all and didn't like us at all. So that was it.
So this is kind of turn of the century.
Yeah, it was 99. So 99 is when we finished the last series of this morning, the second series of this morning. And we kind of knew they weren't going to do another one. We'd been from meetings. John Plan was the executive producer who tried to be supportive. Yeah. They let us do whatever we wanted. And John Plan said, I remember coming and said, there's something they wanted us to cut. And we said we wouldn't cut it. And which is amazing, right? That's the executive producer. Yeah, yeah. And he said, it'll be much better for you in terms of getting another series if you cut this.
Yeah.
And we said, we're not going to cut it.
Right.
But I know that if we'd cut it, we still wouldn't have got another series. Yeah. So it was that kind of, we were that pig-headed, but also behind what we were doing. But also, how the hell were we able to tell executive producer that we were going to do the thing?
And it went out.
Yeah, we did it. There was lots of edgy stuff on that show, and we pushed it. And
you tasted different types of milk.
Yeah, milk.
Animals.
And we, you know, I was
just to give people a flavour if they weren't familiar with it.
There was a lot of stuff about me having sex with animals.
Yes.
They're all like howling monkeys by the time milk. I finished with them. You know, there was things about, there was a mouse escaped and went up my bum, basically. I mean, it's up my mouse hole. Like, someone said twat live on TV. Yeah. We used to sing this King song when we'd crown someone in the audience as the king, and we'd go, far, 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 and I'd be going, far, 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 king, far, 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 king, live on TV, and every do it, wow, 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 king, wow, and I was doing this every week. And so, you know, we were being very naughty, and no one was looking out for it because it was on at a time no one was expecting something this weird.
It was one of those things that could have become part of the furniture.
Yeah, yeah. So I think if we'd done another series,
it might have changed.
Also, if we'd been a little bit more, we had so many ideas and so many characters that we didn't do that thing of repeating the same characters every week. A little bit more in this morning because we had to, because we didn't have enough money.
Sure.
Weirdly, there was a great character that Kevin Eldon did that we'd all worked on together, which is this guy pretending to be Rod Hull that had been in Fist of Fun. He's got the false Rod Hull, and for some reason he pretended to be Rod Hull to get jelly. It was a very long synthesis where it came up, but he was really funny. And we recorded like loads of sketches of him for this morning, and I thought this is going to be the time this breaks through and becomes like a national obsession.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we were sitting on the set ready to record the first one, doing the dress rehearsal. Someone came and said, "It's bad news. Rod Hull has fallen off
his roof, hasn't he?"
So we obviously had to. It's probably worse for Rod Hull than it was for us. But we obviously had to not.
You wouldn't have put that in a script. No. You'd have been handed it back for being too important.
Exactly. Well, it would have been a perfect one of this because in the sketch every week the Rod Hull character died because he was unable to, so there was little bits of bad luck like that, but also, you know, we were too inventive, we were trying too many different things. If we'd done another series, who knows what would have happened. And I'm really glad we didn't, because it gave us both a chance to
break up
without falling out, and do our own thing, and also rediscover who we were. And we both went through a little bit of a wilderness.
Well, I'm interested in your wilderness at the moment, because some of the stuff that occurred during it, you nearly killed yourself writing for Al Murray.
Yeah.
10 episodes in 9 weeks.
It was actually the first series was 22, I think. Yeah, 22. But it was 13 to begin, and they gave us another 9 halfway through the series.
So
I wrote 9 episodes in 10 weeks on my own, because Al was recording them as we were doing. So I was writing an episode a week. I was going in, they recorded them on a Thursday. I'd be starting writing a new script on Wednesday. So Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, I'd write a script. We'd read it on Friday. I'd go over with the weekend, rewrite it. On Monday, we'd have to nail it down.
Yeah.
Monday and Tuesday,
and
they'd rehearse it.
This is high octane.
Yeah.
This is burnout stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Monday and Tuesday, they'd rehearse it. Jesus. I'd be there on Tuesday to help them with the rehearsal. Then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, I'd start writing the next one. They'd record on Thursday.
And how were you rationing? Because we're going to run out of time, and we're not close to 2018 yet. Okay. But how did you deal then with no longer being on the stage. Were you cool with that?
I was all right. I was had a little part in the first series,
yes,
and it was sort of, but it was, you know, it was only just for a bit of fun. And
sure.
Then actually, in the last episode of that, I wanted this. There was this thing where, and it was a little bit of an in joke as well. Although I was actually going out with Julia Sawyer at the time, but in Fist of Fun, Julia Sawyer had been my like
fantasy
pretend, my fancy woman.
I dream of a woman with the head of Julia Sawyer and the body of Julia
exactly.
Sawyer. It's a very good line.
It was. And so we started going out with each other for as things went, and that's partly why she was in that show.
Sure.
And so I was a postman character who was obsessed with her, and she hated him.
That's right.
And in the final episode, I wanted her to kiss him just for some spurious reason. She was trying to make someone jealous or something, and you know, he exploded his world. And then the director said, you know, we've got too much stuff in this episode. And so I had to make the mature decision of cutting this arc for this character. And so I didn't have him. And Julia wasn't in the next series, and we broke up, and which was the reason we went in the next series.
You weren't gnashing your teeth and tearing
I didn't mind. I was sort of, I always wanted to write stuff as well. So
yes.
I'd love to get, you know, that was what I had 35 episodes of a sitcom on. I mean, it was on Sky, but it was on TV.
Yeah.
And we got paid a
proper
ridiculous
money.
Amount of money for it, because I was basically doing 6 years' work in two years.
Just backing up slightly then, at what point would you say you became financially secure?
Only then. I mean, by the end of Lee and Herring, we'd broken even, I would say.
That was all.
When I bought my flat, I think we got paid £30,000 each a series for writing and being in those shows, you know, which is nice.
Sure.
It was a lot of money for me then, but
of
was
course.
Not like a life-changing amount of money. And so, like, you know, you're paying rent for it, most of it, and then I put £10,000 deposit down on the £90,000 flat. Sorry, people of now.
So don't worry about them. They're spending all their money on avocado toast.
But by the end of it, I basically had £0, but
okay.
I was living in a flat. And then I did that Al Murray thing,
we got
proper money. Me and Al split the production fee.
Right.
So it was like, you know, each week, and when I was writing an episode a week, that became my weekly wage.
Yes, of course.
And then there was loads of repeat fees for that, which never happened to me. So that completely set me up.
Okay.
And
then, I didn't know this, script editor on the third series of Little Britain, which sounds as if it was the opposite of doing the Al Murray thing.
Yeah, well, it was.
In terms of effort. And,
yeah, exactly.
Because they did it all themselves.
Matt's
done Unfiltered. And
yeah, well, there was nothing
struggled
I could
to get
do.
A word in Edgeworth.
Yeah, well, it was, you know, if you liked it, it's not my because of me. If you didn't like it, it's not because of me. Yeah, so I went into meetings, and I wrote one character that they didn't use. And but it was basically just going in and try. But weirdly, that was another thing that made me realise podcasting was the way forward.
Right.
Because they were going into meetings and people at the BBC were saying, no, you can't do that.
Yes.
And you're going, this is the third series of this incredibly popular show. And
they
the BBC
should be able to do whatever the hell
and
they
I just
want.
Said to them, why would you go to the BBC, make it yourself, and then sell it back to the BBC, you know, and sell it to everyone? It could be yours. You don't need the BBC.
It's brooms, isn't it? It's people need to make their presence felt. Management and commissioning people. The most confident are the ones who won't touch it.
Yeah.
Everyone else feels they need to leave a fingerprint on it.
But the boys were pushing things like too far. I mean, I think they even the stuff that got on there, I think they, you know, now you look back at it and
he does at least. Matt Lucas does. I haven't spoken to Dave.
And you know, it was, but so it was sort of, it was difficult to stop them doing things. It was, you know, and so yeah, there was no job to it at all, so it wasn't really.
So then, I mean, fast-forwarding violently, you then did the series of one-man shows, 12 or 13 one-man shows, themed 12 Tasks of Hercules. So it's dating 50 women in 50 days. So the idea comes, and then you work out...
Well, that should have been the show, you know, weirdly.
Yeah.
So I had an idea of doing... I was living in a house which had a bust of Hercules on it. I was going through a bit of a depression. I'd broken up with someone. I was probably depressed. It's a nice show. It was the least... it was my least favourite at the time, and it did the worst.
Right.
But because the problem was I was trying to... I did a show which was... an hour-long show in Edinburgh where I tried to describe 12 incredible things I'd done, one of which was Dating 50 Women in 50 Days, which is a show.
Yes.
And so I was emulating Hercules in various of his tasks. Hercules had impregnated 50 women in a night, so I did it slightly differently. And I don't think I impregnated anyone. I set myself a series of challenges. And it's a nice show because it's about someone going into a depression, being a bit crazy, and then finishing all this stuff and coming out the other side. When I redid them all, I did all 12 shows quite recently, and it was a really lovely one to do because it just felt like oh god, that was a real proper journey, like personally, and I was doing crazy stuff.
And you're putting an arm around your younger self slightly.
Well, by doing all those old shows, yeah, it was.
Yes.
But you know, so I was 34 about 34 at that time. It was an amazing it, it, it was very, very important show in me becoming who I am. It gave me lots of confidence. I ended that show, and I'd done 3 one-man shows by that point, but I went, why am I not doing stand-up? Why am I not going to clubs and doing stand-up? So I'd done all these things that challenged me, and I thought, you know, I'm doing stand-up, but I'm not calling it stand-up, and why am I not? And so that's what pushed me back into going into the clubs.
And that leads to the show that you're touring at the moment. But via also... Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast, which was a real game changer.
So all of these things, you know, I think that, again, those decisions, I met my wife 10 years ago and I started podcasting 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And both those decisions have, like, completely obviously changed my life in lots of ways. But, yeah, the podcasting thing, yeah, I'd been doing the podcast with Andrew Collins, and then we'd kind of come to the end of that and we'd not fallen out, but we'd had a disagreement. And I kind of liked doing it. I thought, would it be possible just to do that show with a different person every week? Was really the beginning part thought of it. And then it's turned into much more of an interview show.
Yes. Do you like asking the questions more than answering them?
I like both. And what I like about my podcast is I'm allowed to sit back and let the other person talk. Or my favourite ones are when we just start riffing with someone and, you know, it's nothing about anything and we both find something funny and off you go. But I also am fascinated by... I'm fascinated by comedy and other comedians still, and I love other comedians. I love the young comedians. I love the old comedians. So it's all really interesting to me. So I'm interested to find out about them and how they got where they are. It's given me a lot more respect for... I think, again, when we started, we just thought, you know, as much as I was insecure, we thought we knew everything about comedy and we thought everyone else was terrible. Yeah. You sort of have to. You have to believe that you're...
Just because it's such a big push to stand up and go, I'm the business.
Just to keep going, you have to sort of have this idea. And so you'd be disparaging about everyone. And then you meet them, and then you meet the people who are really successful. Yeah. And I've had really great guests on this, as you clearly have on here. And you suddenly go, oh, I mean, most of them are really nice people still, and down-to-earth people, but they've all worked hard, and they've all, you know, and they're all incredibly talented. And you sort, and it's sort of fair, as much as some great people aren't going to get to that point. All the great people who've got there, you've sort of got to be pretty great to get there. So you see these people and you realize how, you know, someone like David Mitchell, just so witty and so sharp and so clever, and he's brilliant on my podcast because he treats me in exactly the right way with this sort of disdain, but like he treats me like an intelligent 10-year-old, you know. And that's good. That's how it should be. But yeah, I love doing it, and it's always different every week, and it's even those elements of it the same, and it's always. Nearly always fun. Sometimes it's, you know, it's difficult. We're improvising. I do 2 in a night. We're improvising.
2 in a night is tough. Yeah. And a live audience means that sometimes you don't know whether it's... I mean, you get an immediate feedback on whether it's as funny as you think it is or whether it's as magical.
But sometimes, like last week, the audience were quite quiet. Right. And, you know, maybe it was... And I was a bit ill and I had Mackenzie Crook on. I really wanted to impress him.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and then you kind of just not... You feel like, oh, I wasn't quite as good as I could have been.
Yeah.
But mostly I'm just
wrong,
really...
You're wrong, though, can't you, sometimes? Yeah. When you think you've not got it right.
You always come off from people.
You have got it right.
Yeah.
Which leads inexorably towards, oh, frig, I'm 50.
Yes. So I did a show called Oh, Fuck, I'm 40.
Yes.
10 years ago, where I was a very different man. It was just before I met my wife, and I was... And another kind of midlife crisis show.
And, so how long are you going to live?
I've got my midlife crisis. Well, I think the midlife is the middle bit, isn't it?
Yes, of course it is.
Doesn't mean you have to get to 80.
It's not an hour.
It will be in the end. We'll be able to locate the hour. But I was, you know, I was living a very different life than I am now, and it's kind of interesting. I thought it'd be nice to. It's a nice, you know, it's a nice idea to have to do a show every decade. I don't know how many more decades there will be. I joke about this being the penultimate instalment of the franchise. But also there's a big difference between me at 40 and me at 50, because obviously I was single.
And that's what it's about. Changes.
And it's about that, whether at 40 I was really worried about whether I was too old to be childish. And my persona was so... You know, this intellectual puerility is what I've always done. And I think at 40, I thought, oh God, now I might be too old. Now it gets too embarrassing. Yeah. It's too weird. And you know, and also my life was, I wasn't married and I didn't have kids. And had I blown everything out of the water, you know, by just...
You thought the ship had sailed.
Well, yeah, in every way, you know, and should I grow up?
Right.
At 50, I've been forced to grow up in some ways, but I'm still childish.
Yeah.
And so it's still about that, but it's also, I think, about suddenly realizing you get over a certain hump and then it sort of becomes funnier to be childish as you get older as well. So all that's nice, but you've got a bit more wisdom at 50. So it's about looking back and about understanding, you know, you feel like you're in the middle of your life, even though you're in the last part of your life. And you know, you've got, it's that perspective. It's that perspective of my, you know, my personal life and my career that I didn't have 10 years ago.
Do the numbers resonate in real life? Because obviously 40 and 50 in terms of birthday cards and parties and helpful headlines for shows,
yeah,
they're big numbers. But I found 46, I had 46 last month, and yeah, I found that much more troubling than either 40 or 45.
Yeah.
Or, it's weird, isn't it?
It is weird. I mean, 40 really hit me hard.
Did it?
And yeah, but
I waltzed 50, through 40. I
50 doesn't... 50, I mean, I've got other stuff to worry about now. That's the thing. I had nothing to worry about when I was 40. But like mid-40s is...
Mortality, though. Have you taken mortality on board?
Yeah, yeah. No,
you have.
Definitely, yeah. I'm obsessed with death. My wife... I've done a whole show about death.
Of course you have, yes.
My wife is... I have to not talk because I keep on talking about dying all the time.
Well, Eric Cantona, when he was when he was sitting in that chair, I asked him a similar question and he paused for so long that I was worried that he decided not to answer it.
Yeah.
And then just said he was going to find a way to overcome death.
Oh, God.
If anyone can.
Weirdly, I think mid-40s is worse than anything.
Yeah.
Because I think, like, you're still at 40. I mean, that's the difference now. At 40, I look back and I was quite fit and I was handsome and I was sexy and everything was working. There was no feeling anything could go wrong. I was still, you know, young women were still finding me attractive.
Yeah.
It was, and like at 50, and then my life's very different and I'm not trying to be attractive to young women. I would like to be attractive
but
to them,
but
I'm not, you know, I'm not. And so there's all these things you have to cope with and things start to go wrong. And it isn't until the mid-40s that really starts to happen, I think. So as a man, you're lucky in lots of ways, but then it hits you as hard. And I think we're not as prepared because you have this privileged lifestyle and that's,
yes, of course,
you know, and this entitlement and you don't realise... And everyone does what you want. And then suddenly you get 45, 46, 50, and people aren't so much bothered anymore. And so you've got to, you know, women aren't that bothered about you. Work isn't that bothered about you. You have to kind of come to terms with those things. And I think that's why, I mean, there's a big subject, but everything that's exploding at the moment is about these middle-aged boy men who haven't quite, and then suddenly realise that they're not as powerful as they were, they exert their powers in ways that are horrific.
And that is why you are so... relieved that you are in control of your own professional destiny.
Yeah, it's not, you know, it's that autonomy's great. Also understanding, you know, what's important. It's just, you know, it's lovely to be on tour and I love doing the shows, but it's great to come home and see my kids. Got those gigs cancelled because of the snow and you think, oh, it's terrible, that's 2 days' workout. But then I got back to, and I'm not stuck in a snowdrift, I'm with my family. And it was hard, but it was hard one of the days, but it's still, you know, it's great to have that to work for and to go back to that. But yeah, you know, having a perspective and, you know, understanding your own unimportance, and that's sort of what the 50 show's about, is knowing in the grand scheme of things how just time will roll over you and
dust
and you're gone and
dust to dust. How can people see it?
If you go to richherring.com, you can see all the gigs are up on there. I mean, I'm sort of, it goes on till June, but I'm doing tour. It's nicely paced. It's sort of tours for me. It's like two or three a week, so it's not too exhausting.
Especially a man of your age.
Yes, well, it is. It takes
take
a toll.
It takes it out of you.
It's hard, man. I've got a five-month-old
really?
Son at home. Yeah,
they're not going on the road with you.
They aren't, but it's still, the tiredness never leaves you. So it's, but yes, it's a fun show. I'm doing it in London on May the 4th, doing the DVD on May the 4th.
Richard Herring, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm joined now for the traditional post-match analysis by the producer of Unfiltered, Rich Cooper. And he's a talker, but I'll tell you what struck me from an interviewer's point of view that made it a little bit challenging was the fact that he spent so much time thinking about his career. Not in a self-referential or an egotistical way, but last week David Lammy was the polar opposite. He sort of kept getting taken by surprise by things that I said to him about his own life.
Yeah.
And he'd sort of go... Oh, yeah.
I never thought about it.
So, whereas with Richard, because so much of his stage work depends on self-examination, it'd be very hard to say anything to him about him that he hadn't already said to himself.
Absolutely, yeah. I thought we had a similar thing when David Baddiel was on, wasn't he? Like, it's sort of the comedian's job to look at yourself, to look at your life and put it all out there in a package form.
Yes.
Which means thinking about it and analysing it. And I don't know how they don't go crazy.
No. Well, I think they do a bit, mate, to be honest with you. I think that's why you get the sort of mild allusions to depression and things like that. I think that they walk a tightrope, actually, between that.
Yeah,
those
you're probably
two positions.
Right. That's not the life for me.
I liked him a lot. It's not the life for me either. Luckily, I'd get to talk to them about them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, he was really nice. He was great. And As you say, like, this is another one where I can see people tweeting us going like, oh, we need to do a part two. Why wasn't this 2 hours long?
Do you have any idea how hard it is to sort of self-edit and censor while you're doing it, keeping an eye on the clock, trying to hit it on an hour, but also thinking, well, I don't want to move him on from this, or I don't want to move her on from that, because this is really interesting. But it's great.
Yeah.
It means we can run until I'm 50.
Yeah.
You're listening to Unfiltered with James O'Brien, brought to you by Joe.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.